From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last month when a company called Turing Pharmaceuticals bought the rights to a drug that battles the effects of AIDS and cancer. That drug is called Daraprim. It's been around for more than 60 years. It can be life-saving. And compared to many other life-saving therapies, Daraprim has not been expensive. But that changed almost overnight. Turing Pharmaceuticals decided to raise the price for Daraprim roughly 5,000%, from $13.50 per pill to $750 per pill. The outrage was swift and strong. The CEO of Turing is a 32-year-old former hedge fund wunderkind who's been a little bit controversial in the healthcare market for a number of years now. His name is Martin Shkreli, and he initially laughed off claims that the price hike was unethical. Headlines declared that Shkreli was shrugging at the concerns of patients who could no longer afford the medicine. Even some patients with insurance could pay as much as $150 per tablet now. Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, they've called for tighter regulations on how Big Pharma does business in an effort to prevent price hikes of this nature. And finally, Shkreli did a round of interviews explaining that his company is going to be doing research, and research needs a lot more money than Daraprim was providing. He says raising the price was the way to fund better research, a potential victory for patients down the road. So what can we learn from this? Late last night, Turing Pharmaceuticals issued a statement saying they would lower the price for Daraprim in response to the public anger. They have not yet clarified by how much. My guests for this hour include Dr. William Valenti, Trillium Health Vice President and lead physician, and someone who knows Daraprim pretty well, I assume. Dr. Valenti, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Yes.
Dr. Jonathan Hager is here as well. He's a primary care physician and going to be talking to us with a little bit more of a broad lens this hour, Dr. Hager. Nice to have you here as well.
Thanks for having me.
And Jane Dodds is here, a practice administrator with Women, Gynecology, and Childbirth Associates and a member of the board of the New York State Medical Group Management Association. Jane was part of our recent panel in which we talked about price transparency in medicine. Here's our logical extension. Nice to see you back here, Jane.
Thanks, Evan, and thanks for shining a light on the problem.
Well, very good here. Let me start with Dr. Valenti. You know Daraprim pretty well. How often do you work with it?
Have used it a lot in HIV/AIDS, less so in the modern era. The way we use it today is to keep toxoplasmosis, the parasite, suppressed and under control in people with AIDS. And there's also some use for it in malaria. So that's my world. The bigger world, toxoplasmosis is a much more significant problem in the developing world, so having access to this drug is important.
What was your first reaction when you heard about the price change?
Ouch. First concern was access to the drug for patients, because I've seen some of these price increases with other drugs that we use happen in the recent past, and patients aren't always prepared to meet the copay or their part of the cost for these drugs, which begins to shut people out of care rather than bring them into it. Problem.
Yeah, Dr. Valenti, my understanding in this case, and again, I want to preface this conversation by saying there is plenty I don't understand about how the medical pricing world works, and that's partially why I wanted to at least explore this aspect of it. But Dr. Valenti, my understanding was when you go from $13.50 per pill to $750 per pill, you know, some were saying, well, hey, but patients aren't going to be paying the entire $750. But from what I'm reading, there are plenty of patients, even with insurance, who could be paying still $150 a pill. And when you're used to paying, you know, right, $13, $10, whatever you were paying before, that's a huge difference, isn't it?
It's a huge difference, and it brings into the discussion high deductible insurance plans and the way insurance works. Everybody's insurance is just a little bit different. And with more people coming into the system through the Affordable Care Act, there are a variety of plans in which the patient still has some financial obligation. And many people with these high deductible plans, as one example, are really not prepared to write a check for $150 or even $1,000 to for the their part of a prescription. So we have... My reaction was we've got some problems here because of access.
Okay. Before we hear from the CEO of Turing, and I'm going to play his remarks for you in just a moment that will help guide our discussion this hour, let me just ask our other guests what their initial reactions were to the story. Dr. Hager, what did you think when you first heard?
Well, obviously a similar kind of shock because it's such a large number. But this is certainly not the first drug that we've seen this kind of thing with, and certainly in primary care where I work, we've seen this with many different drugs. This one was just such a glaringly large number that it caught the headlines. I think the biggest issues that arose for me watching him were bigger issues about how do we finance R&D, you know, research and development. How do we handle what is a for-profit healthcare system where supply and demand, you know, what is the role of supply and demand? Clearly, when you're going from $1,350 to $750, if your iPhone went up that much overnight, well, you just wouldn't buy the iPhone. You don't have that choice if you have a life-threatening toxoplasmosis infection. So that to me is one of the other big issues is the unnatural marketplace that modern medicine is in this country. And if we don't tackle that bigger issue, you know, all these individual issues about deductibles and copays, they're sort of obscured under this bigger issue that it's not a normal market like every other good in the U.S.
Do you have a brief description of what a cure to that abnormal market would be?
Yeah, if I did, I'd get a Nobel Prize in economics, probably. No, but I see sort of three options, and I think we have the worst in some ways from a cost perspective. If you go to an unindustrialized country where there's no government involvement whatsoever, right there, that's a pure capital market. If you live in rural Sudan and you get sick, if you've got the money, you go and buy a drug. If you don't, you go without. Pure supply and demand. Then you have many, many modern developed countries that have national health insurance where there's price controls. Okay, so the costs of both of those systems are less. In the place with no market whatsoever, there's low cost because people can't afford the drug. In price-controlled markets with single payer, the costs are kept down. Here, we've got this weird hybrid. You know, all the pharmaceutical companies like to talk about free market, but they have the third-party insurers to sort of act as a middleman and push all the costs there.
I don't feel like you're advocating for the rural Sudan version.
No, I'm not.
Okay, but and I'm going to kick it to Jane on this question in just a second. We've talked, and we're not going to do single payer for an hour today, but there's a lot of other tentacles that we've got to get to. But isn't one of the knocks on single payer that it suppresses the profit incentive, which thereby suppresses money for R&D?
Yes, this is certainly a legitimate concern. The issue is there's some balance, you know, with all of these things. No one extreme is correct. And this is an example where the pendulum just has swung so far to an extreme that it stood out. So there needs to be enough profit motive that there is incentive to do R&D. But that also does get to a little bit of a question about who should be funding the R&D. And, you know, I have some concerns about the R&D being led primarily by the pharmaceutical industry. Pharmaceutical industry funds about 60% of the R&D in this country, with the government picking up about 30 and some foundations the rest. But they're only funding research that they can see pretty close down the road is going to be profitable, right? That's understandable. They have no incentive to do basic science research. And so, you know, what their target is may not be the best target for the country and for the drugs that we really need. You know, that was one of the questions I had for Dr. Valenti was,
do
we need a better version of Daraprim?
You know, we're going to get to that in just a second. That's a great question. Okay, so Jane, then what do you make of what we've seen with Daraprim, and how does that fit into the question on the way the system is working?
I think one of the issues is Daraprim is a 70-year-old drug. It's off patent. It's used to treat a very small number of patients, so there's not going to be a huge market no matter what happens. And I think that's why people were so shocked when we realized that the rights to either make or market that can be sold from one from the only company that makes it to another company that can be the only company that makes it. There's not enough revenue to be made for a new company to come into the market because the potential market is so small. But the flip side of that is, I mean, obviously, we need patent protection for people that are going to patent a new medication. And right now, patents, 7 years? And then things go off patent and other companies come in and tweak the drug. I think there's probably not any threat in this country that we'll run out of people who are interested in finding new drugs or vaccines. If I'm not mistaken, the people that developed the polio vaccine gave it away as a community service.
Yes.
So we need to balance between capital markets and the public health.
In just a minute, when you hear the CEO's comments, he mentions the question of giving life-saving drugs away, and he does it in a way that indicates that he found that sort of problematic, which was, and again, I don't mean to characterize, you're about to hear it, but Jane, when you hear that, when you see the headlines that this is an unethical price hike, et cetera, are those headlines too shrill or do you agree?
I think it's important that people start paying attention to that sort of thing. To me, the frustrating part of his interview is when he talks about making the drug available for people with no insurance, and he uses the phrase, what the market will bear. And what he's actually saying is what he can get the private insurance companies to cover.
Yeah, I think he's done just a couple of interviews, and what I want to do now is the time, I think, let's listen to what he's had to say. This is a kind of a lengthy clip. It's about 4 minutes long, and this is the CEO of the company that purchased, essentially purchased Daraprim, the rights to Daraprim. The company is called Turing Pharmaceuticals, and this is their former hedge fund manager owner. The CEO is Martin Shkreli. He was talking to Bloomberg News. Our thanks to Bloomberg News, and let's listen.
Well, you know, we needed to turn a profit on the drug. And we're the first company to really focus on this product. And I think that's a great thing because ultimately the companies before us were actually just giving it away almost. You know, the price that they were pricing it at was the price.
$13.50.
Yeah, $13.50, okay. And you only need less than 100 pills. So, you know, at the end of the day, the price per course of treatment to save your life was only $1,000. And we know these days in modern pharmaceuticals, cancer drugs can cost $100,000 or more. Rare disease drugs can cost $500,000.
Mm-hmm.
Daraprim is still underpriced relative to its peers.
But my understanding was that to actually produce this pill, what, cost only a dollar?
It costs very little to make Daraprim.
Okay, so then how are they losing money if they were selling it at $13.50?
The cost of production is not the only cost, right? So you have distribution costs, you have obviously FDA costs, you have manufacturing costs that not are just included by the cost of goods sold for the pill itself, the ingredients, but also the people that make the pill and make sure that it's made to specification. Those costs have increased dramatically over the years. So this product was
dramatically up 5,000% to 7,000.
They're not 5,000%, but they were. This drug was doing $5 million in revenue, and I don't think you could find a drug company on this planet that could make money on $5 million of revenue. Most costs are much higher than that.
Okay, so your contention is that they were losing money, only generating $5 million.
And not providing dedicated patient services. Rare diseases are not like buying, you know, Advil or something. This is a very, very tough disease. It requires a lot of attention and focus from the drug company. Has to partner with the patients and distributors and really make sure that it's a very cared for community. And that costs a lot of money too.
Well, Martin, some of the reaction in the medical community from various doctors, you know, there was one in particular at Mount Sinai, head of infectious diseases, said that, you know, look, this means that we're going to have to, the price of this means we're going to have to look for alternative treatments. We can't take Daraprim anymore. And we won't be able to keep this drug, because it's so expensive now, in stock, and that may delay treatment for some patients.
So we've put the right protocols in place to make sure, in fact, that patients get the drug faster and with almost no cost. So previously there were copays for this drug. We have a copay assistance program that will limit that. Previously there was a limited free drug program. We've expanded that. And if you can't afford the drug, we'll give it away totally for free, especially if the patient's in need or doesn't have an income. So,
but then how does that intersect with your, you know, a stated objective, which is that you need to make money off of this drug?
Well, it's an impediment, but at the same time, you know, we will never deny someone treatment for their ability to pay it.
Martin, because it is, you know, so much more expensive, though, you know, aren't there going to be other drug companies who are now going to come on board and say, okay, then we'll make generic versions of this then, and we'll sell it for cheaper?
Sure, and I think that's a great thing. You know, at the end of the day, if you look at diseases like multiple myeloma or multiple sclerosis, they've been transformed dramatically by profit incentive. And now that toxoplasmosis has companies actually generating a profit. Mm-hmm. Remember, this drug's from 1940s.
Right.
1940s. We can make a better drug for this disease.
But is that what you're trying to do, though?
Absolutely.
Is put the drug out of business?
Absolutely. We're spending tens of millions of dollars to make a better version of Daraprim that is more effective, less toxic. Daraprim is a very toxic drug. And these patients deserve a drug company that is turning a profit, a fair profit, and also developing a drug that is better for them. They don't deserve a drug that's 70 years old. They deserve a modern medicine that can cure toxoplasmosis quickly. There's a lot of issues with toxoplasmosis. We know there's a better way to treat this disease. You know, we are developing three or four different kinds of new drugs for toxoplasmosis. Remember, no one's cared about this illness for a long time from the pharmaceutical perspective, if ever. And I think that's a terrible thing if you're suffering from toxoplasmosis. Now you have a powerful ally in our company that is looking to make new drugs for you, is willing to spend that money. And to do that, we all know drug development is very expensive. They estimated a new drug can cost $1 billion to develop. Mm-hmm. It's only fair that we make profit and we take that money and we put it back into the patient's hands. I don't advocate for companies that raise price and don't do any research. And by the way, there are dozens of those. So
right.
The spotlight on me is an interesting thing. I'm not thinking too hard about it because I know what we're doing is right. But at the end of the day, you know, we are...
Right, but doctors would say at the end of the day, if it was working, why break it then?
It's interesting. So for infectious diseases, you may know that these bugs evolve. They become resistant. In fact, if we still had to focus on penicillin, which is about 70 years old, we'd be in big trouble today. Mm. And the reality is that, you know, by making a better version of Daraprim, 2 billion people have this. In fact, there's a good chance one of the two of us has it. And if the latent form is totally fine, but if you become immunosuppressed, it can kill you. And so if this bug evolves, it'll be a ticking time bomb, and I think we need to prepare now in case the toxoplasma mutates. And we know that Daraprim, our drug, mm-hmm. does not cure you 100% of the time. It's about an 80% rate. Okay. I think we can get that up to 100 with research.
All right, that is Bloomberg News and the interview with the CEO of Turing. That's Martin Shkreli talking to Bloomberg. A lot to digest there. I want to start with Dr. William Valenti. He's saying Daraprim's only 80% effective. He wants a 100% effective. That's why they've raised the price 5,000%, and they're going to pour the money into that, and it's vital for people who need Daraprim. Is that right?
Well, it's a relative yes. He raises some good points in terms of cleaner, newer drugs, the way drugs work in terms of efficacy, the 80% versus 100% rate. You know, we've gotten used to this drug over the years and can manage it pretty well. It does have some side effects, of course, and would certainly welcome something cleaner and better. I think the real rub, though, with this is the way it was done and the dramatic price increase that really is a bitter pill, if I may, for a lot of us. Because, like it or not, the problems of access still need to be overcome, even if he has a drug assistance program making it available for indigent people. The fact is that at that price and with the new distribution system through one pharmacy, it's not something that we would keep on the shelf anymore. And I think that does delay treatment and causes some gaps in care that we should be thinking about here.
Is it too dramatic to say that people could die? And I'm not trying to put a garish headline out there, but if people don't get Daraprim and they need it, could they die?
Sure. More likely, though, delays in treatment sort of affect the way the disease is managed long term, because there can be some significant brain complications, neurologic complications with some forms of toxo. So there's that issue. Poorly treated malaria worldwide is another. The real issue that I see with in situations like this is, well, we'll scramble and figure out an alternative plan to avoid the worst situation, death. But those delays in treatment are not only frustrating for healthcare people, but dangerous for patients in terms of getting rid of that disease as best we can.
All right. I want to ask the panel, and you're hearing from Dr. William Valenti, who is Trillium Health's vice president and lead physician and has worked with Daraprim over the years at Trillium. So if we accept the premise that Daraprim is 80% effective and the CEO of the company that now controls it wants it to be 100% effective, And Daraprim is, he called it a pretty toxic drug, and they want a cleaner version. Those things, if we accept them as true, then I think what we have to do is a bit of a cost-benefit, right? Because for $13.50 a pill, it's pretty cheap, and it still can be life-saving, even in its pretty toxic 80% effective form. To get to the less toxic 100% effective, or close to 100% effective, again, he said a new drug costs about $1 billion to create. If this is reworking an existing drug, maybe tens upon tens of millions of dollars. Is it worth it, the lack of access, Dr. Valenti, that some may have right now to help people in the future who are going to have toxoplasmosis and want a cleaner drug and a more effective drug? You know, you see what I'm saying? I understand where he wants to go with it, but if it impacts a pretty significant number of current patients or near-future patients, is that an ethical trade-off that you make?
That's the rock and hard place discussion. But my answer is, well, could you do what you want to do in your R&D with less money? And, I mean, do you need to move the price? Give us a chance to adjust to these price changes and see how the system works, because I'd want to test his system in terms of, okay, then here I've got a patient without insurance, give me some drug, let's see how fast it gets into the patient. There are a lot of balls in the air with this sort of thing in terms of making treatment happen. And I just want to make sure that for my $750 a pill, that he really is able to deliver at the end. And I think my colleagues here would agree that putting the pieces of the system together is problematic.
There's no guarantee they will deliver a better Daraprim, and if they do, it'll take years. And so the question is, in that intervening time, what happens to the people who need it? Especially because, as Dr. Valenti is telling us, this hit like a sledgehammer. Turing takes over. They didn't notify the medical community, we're thinking about a price increase, we're going to be focusing on R&D, get ready. It was like, boom, here it happens. Dr. Hager, what stands out to you from the interview that you heard with the CEO, Martin Cicrelli?
Well, 2 points related to what you just said. The cost effectiveness issue is an interesting one, and it's somewhat of a toxic term for the pharmaceutical industry. In the Affordable Care Act, or what some people call Obamacare, it was expressly written into the Affordable Care Act that the Secretary of Health could not use cost effectiveness data. There's a institute called PCORI, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, which is tasked bringing all these stakeholders together and looking at cost effectiveness. They were prohibited from analyzing this in order to get the pharmaceutical companies on board with doing this, because it's such a complicated topic, the cost effectiveness. And I think, from my perspective in primary care, there are plenty of examples of drugs that really aren't cost effective that that get put into the pipeline. And, you know, the costs are not just borne by the individual patient who has toxoplasmosis. In fact, part of the reason I'm saying the current system is so broken is that with the insurers in there, the goal of the drug company is to make money, obviously. And so they will charge the insurance company as much as they humanly can, because the patient's going to have a $20 or $50 copay. Maybe with these high deductibles now, those numbers are going up. But it's still a relatively small amount of money compared to the overall cost that the insurance company is paying. Those costs, of course, get passed on to all of us. So even if that new version of Daraprim is going to be better, Those are costs that are being borne by all of us. And so that's where having some sort of more centralized approach to what do we want to research, what is cost effective, but that gets into more kind of government-related, you know, guiding research.
Let me ask Jane Dodge then, practice administrator with Women Gynecology and Childbirth Associates then. Go ahead, Jane.
I have two things. One is that the cost that the patient ends up paying is often their relationship with their insurance company. Insurance companies, as private as private companies, can negotiate drug prices with the drug industry. Medicare, the federal program for people over age 65, is not allowed to negotiate.
Why not?
Congress put that in place when they put the Part D drug program in under George Bush.
Back in 2004.
The Part D drug plan prohibited Medicare from negotiating, but allows the private insurance companies that sell Medicare Advantage plans. Those companies can negotiate drug prices. And now what we see is people pointing at the private plans and saying, see, they're more cost effective, without acknowledging that Medicare's hands are tied in terms of negotiating costs. The second thing I'd like to ask of the CEO of Turing is to explain his costs and what part of the costs are for the CEO. Did he think when he left the hedge fund industry and became a drug manufacturer that he was going to earn the same dollars with the same tax benefits as he did when he was a hedge fund manager? We need to look, when he says the costs are high, I want to know what part of that cost is involved.
What percentage of the profit, and that's his word, what percentage of the profit off right. the new price for this drug goes into R&D? That's what you want to know?
And goes, what part of it is his salary and what part of it is their marketing and their legal fees?
Okay. Well, yeah, I don't know what he'd say. He might say we're in a free market here. And,
we absolutely are, but we should know.
Let's get a short break, and we're going to come back. We have a lot of phone calls waiting with questions on this issue, and I'm going to bring in, as well, in just a minute, I'm going to bring in Dr. Hanny Gelbard, who's the director of the Center for Neural Development and Disease and a professor of neurology at the School of Medicine and Dentistry at URMC, and his research focuses on HIV-associated neurocognitive disorder. We'll talk about the cost of research and what we're seeing with Daraprim. I think Jane said it so well, and you heard Dr. Hager say it. This is not the first drug that saw a big increase in price essentially overnight. This is one that was such a big increase, roughly 5,000%. It's getting headlines, and maybe the conversation's one we've needed to have for a long time. So let's continue it next on Connections. And coming up Thursday on Connections, we're talking about the vegan lifestyle in the first hour, film coming to the Little Theater, and we'll talk about various other aspects of going vegan in the first hour. Then the second hour, the Women's Hall of Fame and new inductees. We'll tell you who's on the list and talk to the people involved with the selection with the Women's Hall of Fame. It's all coming up Thursday on Connections.
A father loses his son to war in Afghanistan. Then he befriends his son's interpreter.
I was always assigned to John for going on the missions. He became really close friend with me.
The U.S. has promised to resettle these interpreters, but thousands are still waiting for visas. One interpreter's story later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our discussion this hour is on the question of the price hike for Daraprim. It happened last month when Turing Pharmaceuticals purchased Daraprim, bought the rights to this drug that can be a life-saving drug for people who have issues with, and what's the name of it, Dr. Valenti?
Toxoplasmosis.
Yeah, and the short definition of toxoplasmosis is?
Parasite, very commonly found in undercooked food, meat, poultry, venison, lamb, pork.
And not exclusively a problem of people with AIDS, but in particular it can be seen in the AIDS community.
Many of us have it already. It's sitting quietly. When you become immunosuppressed with certain diseases, cancer, HIV, AIDS, it can become active.
Okay, and so this pill that has been around for 6 decades has helped people with that. And it's been $13.50 for a while. Price went up overnight to $750. And if you missed Martin Shkreli's interview that we played with Bloomberg News earlier this hour, he's the CEO. He defended it and said, look, we want to do R&D. It's been too long since we improved Daraprim. It's a toxic drug. We can do better. It's going to cost tens upon millions of dollars, if not more. We had to raise the price. It's in line with what research costs. Let me bring in Dr. Harris Handy Gelbard, who is the director of the Center for Neural Development and Disease and a professor of neurology at the School of Medicine and Dentistry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Dr. Gelbard, thanks for taking the time to join the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
When it comes, go ahead. Initial thoughts, go right ahead.
Well, specifically, I think that I'd have to say I've had the relatively unique experience of working in sort of a It doesn't qualify for orphan disease status, but I've spent about the last 10 or 15 years developing an entirely new small molecule therapy for HIV-associated neurocognitive disorders. And I have done this entirely through the generosity of the taxpayers, through National Institute of Mental Health and National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease program designed to facilitate studies like this that are literally meant to go from the bench to the bedside. And when I started this, I started it with the knowledge that, of course, drug companies will tell you the cost of bringing an entirely new agent into existence is approximately $1.2 billion. And that's so far above any academic's pocketbook, even with institutional or multi-institutional support, that it just didn't seem possible. And that's far from the case. While I have no idea exactly how Big Pharma controls their financial outlays, and while I can readily accept the fact that they may have resources that are orders of magnitude greater than what's been available to us, we've had approximately, and again, from NIH terms, extraordinarily generous, and we feel encumbered by the responsibility of having received this sort of money, but we've had about $25 million from the NIH since for about a decade and a half now towards this effort. And we started by repurposing already FDA-approved medicine. We found for neurologic disease, we found that repurposing medicine, while it afforded us some symptom modifying effects, there was nothing directly that we were doing that was ever going to be disease modifying, which was our rationale for going off into the world wilderness and doing this. And so I'm listening to the other callers and of course being painfully aware of what this CEO has done with a 62-year-old compound, pyrimethamine, both the academic physician side of myself and just, you know, the general fair-mindedness of what should be a reasonable cost for the consumer to bear, of course I find this as egregious as everybody else. I can tell you that much of that $25 million that we've used to develop both a series of compounds that are our backups in case this compound ultimately is deemed unsuitable as we march towards the IND approval to the FDA, has been really sort of levied at doing not only the basic science and the conceptual work, but making sure the additional hurdle of coming up with a medicine that doesn't do anything adverse to modern chemotherapy for HIV. And thus far, we've been successful, and we're happy to open our books and show exactly what we did, why we did it, and how we made the jump forward, which has essentially been to start a small company that is independent of an academic setting, which is also very lean and is in the middle of a what's called a round A raise, which is about $5 or $6 million, and those costs really go towards not only a manufacturer of a very pure form of the substance, but of course, as I alluded to earlier, all the enabling steps for preclinical toxicology and safety that go along with vetting a new compound and giving it drug-like status at the FDA.
Okay. Well, let me just, Doctor, can I just jump in and ask you a brief question, and I will also ask the panel, and then we'll try to devote the rest of the hour to our callers who have a lot of, I think, important questions on this subject. The CEO pointed to a couple of other cases that I don't have enough knowledge about to comment, but he said, why should this profit incentive be the model, and why will it be successful with Daraprim? Again, I know, Doctor, you're saying it feels egregious to you. He says, look at the therapies, the treatments for multiple myeloma and multiple sclerosis. He said they've been transformed dramatically for the good by profit incentive. And I don't know if that's right, but he's pointing to those two as examples and says we're going to try to do the same with toxoplasmosis and Daraprim. What do you make of that?
It still sounds, knowing the structure of pyrimethamine and toxoplasmosis, it's not a drug that is in any way, shape, or form or obsolete. I could understand more of an impetus for doing this if there were a therapeutic incentive, if there was enough resistance to the drug or that it no longer worked, that they desperately needed to advance development from an entirely new chemical entity. But this strikes me as being unduly opportunistic in this particular intellectual property.
Dr. Valenti, was it losing its efficacy that you're seeing, Daraprim?
No. No, I think the real issue of drugs and efficacy, are patients taking the drugs correctly? Are we monitoring them correctly? I mean, there's a lot of responsibility that goes into taking care of and curing disease. So I would just want to make sure. In other words, when it's done correctly, it's worked in my experience.
All right. I want to get to the phones. And Tim, go ahead. Tim's first up.
It's who wants to be the martyr? Who wants to be the guinea pig? Because if it's me or my wife or kids who unfortunately has this, but, you know, it's for the betterment of society in the long run, are we supposed to, you know, if we're deemed that we can afford $700 a pill, which not many people really can, should we be the ones paying that or attempting to pay for it? And if we can't, then we should know in the back of our minds that, you know, this is for the betterment of society. You know, people will benefit from our loss. And, you know, Martin's got a great way of speaking. He's very smooth, and it just sounds like he's trying to snow people over. And who is it? Who decides who can afford this? I mean, so you're at the doctor's office or the pharmacy, and they say, "Oh, well, you are paying $700 for this." But and Martin says, "Well, no, we would never deny anyone." So on the spot, can you just say, "Oh, well, we can't afford this," and he said that we would never be denied. So can't we have our pill? Or are you going to have to wait around and jump through hoops like you're going to have to do and go through your insurance company and God knows what else to get your prescription, which I'm assuming isn't going to happen that day? I mean, it's just anyone with a half a brain can read right through this guy. And I understand that they're there to make a profit. I'm not saying that he needs to work pro bono, but you got to be kidding me. I mean, I am not the smartest person in the world, but even I understand what's going on here.
Tim,
so who wants to sign up for this? Who wants to be the one that makes the world a better place?
Well,
it ain't me.
Tim, thank you for the call. And Tim raises, I think, a very important point here. He's right. Martin, in the interview, the CEO of Turing, did really sound really compassionate when he said, "Well, no one's going to be denied. We're going to make sure you get this." And you know, Jane, can you accept that the CEO is saying, "Hey, if you can't afford it, we'll send it to you for nothing."
He's saying that, but I don't think he has a drug distribution system. I mean, as we know, he's distributing the drug through a selected pharmacy chain, and he's expecting that people with insurance will pay the freight for the people who don't have it.
You said, Jane said a minute ago about the polio vaccine. When Jonas Salk developed the polio vaccine in the 50s, there was no patent. It was made available and out there. I mean, there's something called the greater good here.
Dr. Hager?
Yeah, well, what the caller mentioned about, you know, being at the pharmacy and how do you get the drug for free if you say you can't afford it, and I've experienced this as a primary care physician. I've filled out paperwork to help patients who can't afford it get drugs because the pharmaceutical companies have lots of these patient support plans, and it's certainly very well-intentioned. It's a generous thing for the pharmaceutical companies to do. But there are practicalities that takes time. You often have to provide a tax return to prove your income, which a lot of low-income people don't have tax returns. And just the time it takes for some of these things to happen, you know, not just with pharmaceuticals, but you know, I watched a patient of mine who had no insurance die from ovarian cancer because we could not get the paperwork for the free CAT scan and the free drugs and the free all the stuff done in time. And she ended up dying without getting any treatment whatsoever. And so in theory, he's, you know, the CEO is got a great idea. But in reality, that stuff does not happen lickety-split.
It sounds like a nice idea. Don't worry. If you can't afford it, we'll cut the price for you. But unfortunately, in practice, I think what Dr. Hager is saying, good luck with that idea. It's an approach. We're also, I want to get back to the phones in just a second. I want to know if, Dr. Gelbart, if you think this is an outlier or if this is symptomatic of the system. And again, this feels like we're really sort of offering a verdict on the system right now, but a lot of the commentary on the system is this hybrid thing is very expensive. It's very cumbersome. So you've got a company here that raises the price 5,000% overnight. Dr. Gelbart, is that symptomatic of the problem with the system, or is that the case of one company doing something that you find egregious?
I can't say that what he's done is anything but egregious, but I think it's symptomatic of the system. What I tried to do in a 2-minute or a 3-minute spiel, and forgive me for saying this, it wasn't to advertise for what we were doing. We were addressing what we thought was an unmet medical need, and we firmly believe it still is. But we're also saying that it could conceivably be done far leaner and what we as the public are presented with in terms of the cost of technology and drug development. I don't think that $1.2 billion is a reasonable burden for everybody to shoulder when that is supposed to be reflected in the cost of a new treatment every time new knowledge or a new development comes along. So I think it's symptomatic of the system.
By the way, for our panel, I was not able to alight upon any perfect single statistic on what Big Pharma spends on ads versus what they spend on R&D, but everything I'm seeing indicates they spend a lot on ads, maybe more on ads than R&D. Jane, you're nodding.
I believe that's true.
Okay.
Yeah, look at the way the drug companies advertise on TV. They sometimes start advertising a medication before they're even licensed to sell it, without really telling you what the drug is for. It's interesting to watch some of those ads.
Yeah, and so that's why you have Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, and a few others saying there should be a requirement that if you are going to raise prices at all on this stuff, that a certain percentage must go into R&D. I think that's in response to saying, hearing people like Martin Shkreli saying, hey, we need tens of millions of dollars for R&D to make this better, and then seeing the majority of that money going not to R&D, but to things like advertising. Let me get back to the phones, and this is Carlene. Go ahead, Carlene.
The words blind robbery come to mind. This is so egregious, as the one caller mentioned. How many other instances of this have occurred because people just think they're rolling stuff over to their insurance company? So a lot of it doesn't come to light until claims get denied or whatever. Or shockingly, you look at that printout that you get from Medicare, whatever, and you say, oh, my God, that pill is such and such. I think what we have here, first of all, I think the numbers are wrong on the research and development. Somewhere I heard that the actual number of pharmaceuticals developed by universities and others who these companies buy the patent from is far greater than what the companies do themselves. And you are correct, and I believe the advertising budget is about 100% to 200% more than any R&D. But the fact, I think what's wonderful about this particular circumstance is because it's so bad. I mean, it's bad enough if it went up 200% or 300%. We're all still paying for it, and it's the reason why people can't afford health insurance or why the government doesn't get a better price on medications. This is so disgusting.
Well,
I'm sorry. How many other how many other instances related to this do we have?
Carlene, that's a good question, and Dr. Hager and I were talking on the phone yesterday about this, because again, this is not the first drug that we've seen the price jump essentially overnight. What else comes to mind for you, Dr. Hager?
Well, there were a couple of very commonly used drugs, at least in primary care, that there was one that's called colchicine, which is used to treat gout, and that went from being a 50-year-old generic drug to being patent protected and went backwards, and the price, of course, went up, 800%. More recently, there was a case with digoxin, which is a very common heart medication, which if you don't take that, you can end up back in the hospital. And there was no clear reason why the drug price went up, 700-800% over the course of a couple of years. And because there were no patent issues, there was no shortage issues, no manufacturing. And the short answer came down to being that there were not enough generic manufacturers in the market. And when you only have two generic manufacturers, it's a duopoly. It's close enough to a monopoly that the prices, they just keep raising the prices with each other. And it's almost, it's not.
So we'll see more of this. Yes?
Again, this is one of the problems with the financing of who's going to build generic drugs, because the CEO has a point. There is not a lot of incentive for some of these generic drugs, especially a short-term drug like this one that you're going to take for 100 days. Antibiotics, other short-term generics, we need to figure out who's going to finance that, because the drug companies don't have an incentive to work on those drugs.
Well, the other thing is in my world, a lot of these price hikes come without any notice, and we don't find out about it until the patient experiences sticker shock at the pharmacy counter when trying to pick up a prescription and then declines the prescription, and we end up going without that particular treatment. In this case, there was enough of a public outcry that it got on the radar screen very quickly. But yeah, I think the answer is that we will continue to see this. I wish we could find a way to be a little more vigilant, though.
Well,
so we knew what to
expect. And I was just going to say, I think our panel has agreed. I mean, not the first time. I don't know if we've ever seen 5,000% overnight. That's a lot. But we'll see it again. And then the question becomes, does the public react to this and then sort of move on to other things, or does the public become more vigilant and respond? Because that's the only way systems change, is if you see part of an issue there. Jane?
Or do we allow the government to talk about cost effectiveness, and do we allow the government to negotiate prices? They negotiate prices in the VA system, but not in the Medicare system. And so why does Congress let that happen?
Dr. Hager?
Well, the answer is because the only way the pharmaceutical industry would allow the Medicare Part D to come into effect was if they were not allowed to negotiate for prices. So this was a contingency. It's the same reason that the pharmaceutical company got behind the Affordable Care Act, is that they could not negotiate prices. So otherwise, the pharmaceutical industry would have blocked Obamacare. And they were one of the key industries that allowed the Affordable Care Act to go through, but that was their price.
See, we're seeing how the sausage gets made, and I don't know if we like the sausage. Let me just ask real briefly, Dr. Gelbard, you had Charlene saying that in her understanding, university research or university-based research, et cetera, has been more successful in creating drugs than what Big Pharma is doing on its own. I don't know the answer to that. Briefly, do you?
I'd say that perhaps I can't give you a short, blunt, direct answer because I don't know of how many successful results there are out there. I still wouldn't call our efforts at this point. We're hoping to be successful. It's a long road to get there, but I do think the one thing that universities are less encumbered by is the academic freedom to be driven more by greater good or actually trying to advance new concepts in healthcare without having to make it strictly a business decision.
Okay.
So I know because I've been told that our own efforts never would have been successful in the context of Big Pharma. So I'm of course very much in support of this. I think we're also open to a lot more scrutiny because we are the recipients of federal funds, and you know, it's pretty much it's a matter of public record what we do. Right. So I'm going to say that the answer, my qualified answer, is yes.
All right. Well, then let me get my other guests to offer some final thoughts in the last 90 seconds here. Jane, you said, what do we do about this? Well, number one, we be more vigilant. We pay attention when price increases happen, not just of the 5,000% variety. But you also said you'd like to see a change to allow for more price negotiation. When it comes to a possible move to it's a pipe dream at this point, but if you ever move to single payer, would you worry that R&D could collapse, or could we get R&D funded satisfactorily in a single payer system?
I think we can work out the inherent conflict between the capitalist system and private drug companies and private manufacturing companies. As long as there's a patent system in place, we can make sure that that doesn't work it in our to our detriment.
Okay. Dr. Hager, some final thoughts? What we do about this?
The pharmaceutical companies still make a profit in Canada, in Europe, where there are single-payer systems. It is possible to have a for-profit pharmaceutical industry in a single-payer system. I think the fundamental issue we have to look at is, do we want healthcare and medications to be a capital market like cars and iPhones and all these other things? Or should that be in the realm of water, power, police, and firefighting, where it's a baseline good? We put the taxes in there to pay for it for everybody. Research, you pay for the taxes for research. Or do we want it to stay private?
In about 25 seconds, Dr. Valenti, on when it comes to Daraprim, what do you do next at Trillium?
We'll find a way to get it. We help subsidize drug costs. In the meantime, I advise patients, understand how your health insurance works.
It's great advice and a wonderful panel. We covered a lot of ground, and my great thanks to Dr. Bill Valenti over at Trillium Health. They've been serving the community for decades, and thank you so much for taking the time, Dr. Valenti. Dr. Jonathan Hager, a primary care physician. Dr. Hager, thank you for your expertise. Jane Dodds is here, and Jane from the practice administrator with Women Gynecology and Childbirth Associates. Thank you, Jane. And Dr. Handy Gelbard, the director of the Center of Neural Development and Disease and a professor of neurology at the School of Medicine and Dentistry at URMC. Thank you, doctor. And
thanks
to all of our listeners for calling and adding their thoughts. If we didn't get you on the phone today, we're not done with the subject. We'll come back soon. Thanks for listening to Connections right here on member-supported public radio.